From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is a national disaster. Get every doggone Greyhound bus line in the country and get the asses moving to New Orleans.
No food, no water, no nothing. Whatever we had, we've been taking it. That's the only way we could survive.
They got the food right here. Let me show you right here.
It's not about low income. It's not about rich people, poor people. It's about people. Nobody wants to hurt anybody in this city. Nobody wants to hurt these people who have these businesses.
Hurricane Katrina. 5 years ago, the storm slammed into the Gulf Coast. More than 1,800 people were killed, most of them in New Orleans, which was flooded and changed forever. Today, we go back 5 years to remember the immediate aftermath of disaster, and we'll go to New Orleans to speak with civil rights attorney Tracy Washington, community organizer Jordan Flaherty. His new book is called Floodlines: Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. We'll also talk to poet Sunny Patterson. She lived in the Lower Ninth Ward, but is now displaced in Houston. But first, The Big Uneasy. A new documentary says the destruction of New Orleans was an unnatural disaster.
We all know what happened in New Orleans on August 29th, 2005. Katrina.
The biggest natural disaster.
Katrina was a natural disaster.
A major American city went through a natural disaster.
Unlike Katrina, where you had a natural disaster.
Katrina, the hurricane, did so much damage in the water.
This natural disaster.
This was not a natural disaster. In fact, this was a very unnatural disaster. This was a disaster caused by people.
We'll talk to the filmmaker, actor, and activist Harry Shearer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamath. Amy Goodman is taking off this week. Federal authorities have launched an investigation into a fire set at the site of a future Islamic center and mosque in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, 35 miles outside of Nashville. The apparent arson destroyed an earth mover and damaged three other vehicles. The equipment was reportedly doused with gasoline and set on fire on Friday night or early Saturday morning. On Sunday afternoon, 9 gunshots were fired near the construction site. Kami Ayash, a spokeswoman for the Islamic Center of Murfreesboro, told Channel News 5 in Tennessee that many area Muslims are now afraid to leave their homes.
Members of the community are very scared. As I mentioned before, it's Ramadan. We try to come together as a community in the evenings to break our fast together. Our attendance level has been very low because people are scared to leave their homes.
The Islamic Center in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, has been the target of protests for months. Vocal opponents have included the Christian evangelist Pat Robertson and Tennessee's Lieutenant Governor Ron Ramsey, who recently suggested Islam is not a religion but a cult. Other opponents have claimed the site could be turned into a terrorist training center. In Mexico, suspected drug traffickers have assassinated the mayor of a city in the border state of Tamaulipas. Marco Antonio Leal was shot Sunday while driving through the rural municipality of Hidalgo. The mayor's young daughter was injured in the attack. Leal is the second mayor in Mexico to be assassinated in the past month. The state of Tamaulipas, which borders Texas, is where the bodies of 72 murdered migrant workers were found last week. Meanwhile, on Friday, two car bombs exploded in Ciudad Victoria, the capital of Tamaulipas. One of the bombs exploded outside the studio of Televisa, Mexico's leading television network. More than 28,000 people have died in drug violence since Mexican President Felipe Calderon took office in December 2006. The Food and Drug Administration is set to announce plans to start inspecting factory egg farms following the massive recall of eggs tied to an outbreak of salmonella in the Midwest. Most of the nation's largest egg farms have gone uninspected for decades. The new inspection plan covers all egg farms that have 50,000 or more hens. In news from Africa, a forthcoming UN report on the Democratic Republic of Congo says crimes committed by Rwanda's army and Congolese rebels during the 1990s in the Congo could be classified as genocide. The New York Times reports the UN report bluntly challenges the conventional history of events in the region after the 1994 Rwandan genocide. The UN report charges that after the genocide ended in Rwanda, Tutsi-led Rwandan troops and their rebel allies killed tens of thousands of members of the Hutu ethnic group inside the Congo. A draft of the report states, quote, the majority of the victims were children, women, elderly people, and the sick, who were often undernourished and posed no threat to the attacking forces. The U.S.-supported Rwandan government has dismissed the findings of the UN report, and the government is threatening to reconsider its contributions to UN peacekeeping missions if the draft report is published. And in Pakistan, it has been a month since torrential monsoon rains triggered the country's worst natural disaster on record. As many as 20 million people have been left homeless due to the massive flooding. UN officials say an estimated 72,000 children in flood-affected areas are at high risk of death because of severe malnutrition. Pakistani resident Amanullah Khan said children have been especially hit hard by the flooding.
Diseases are spreading because of the floods. The skin on children's feet is getting infected. They also have upset stomachs and gastric problems. They are also getting eye infections. We have received no help from the government. There is no medical camp here.
Meanwhile, Pakistani officials are battling to save the delta town of Tata in the southern province of Sindh. Water has already broken the banks of the Indus River near Tata and also topped a feeder canal running off the river. 95% of the town's 300,000 residents have already fled their homes. An influential Israeli rabbi is coming under criticism after he gave a sermon Saturday in which he prayed for all Palestinians to perish in plague. Rabbi Ovadia Yosef is the founder of the Shas Party, part of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition government.
May our enemies and haters end. Abu Mazen and all these evil people should perish from this earth. God should strike them and these Palestinians, evil haters of Israel, with a plague.
Rabbi Ovadia Yosef's comments come just days before Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas are scheduled to begin direct talks in Washington. Palestinian Authority spokesperson Ghassan Khatib condemned the rabbi's remarks.
The statement that we heard from Ovadia Yosef is a racist incitement statement that is responsible for increasing the hatred and deepening the racist attitude among the Israeli society.
In Washington, competing rallies were held Saturday on the 47th anniversary of the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech. The right-wing Fox News broadcaster Glenn Beck organized a large rally in front of the Lincoln Memorial, the same site as the 1963 march. Many of the speakers, including Sarah Palin, repeatedly invoked Martin Luther King's name.
You have the same still spine and the moral courage of Washington and Lincoln and Martin Luther King. It is in you. It will sustain you as it sustained them. So with pride in the red, white, and blue, with gratitude to our men and women in uniform, let's stand together. Let's stand with honor. Let's restore America. God bless you and God bless America.
Meanwhile, civil rights leader, the Reverend Al Sharpton, organized a counter rally called Reclaim the Dream. He accused Glenn Beck of disgracing Martin Luther King's name.
We wouldn't disgrace today by allowing you to provoke us. No matter what you say, no matter what you do, we gonna celebrate those that laid down their lives to give us a chance. This ain't about them, this is about Dr. King.
In economic news, the unemployment rate for youths reached a record 19.1% last month. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, it was the highest midsummer jobless rate for the 16 to 24-year-olds since record-keeping began in 1948. The youth unemployment rate has nearly doubled over the past 2 years. Meanwhile, a prominent economist from the University of Maryland is warning the U.S. economy could experience painfully slow growth and high unemployment for another decade or longer as a result of the economic crisis and the collapse of the housing market. Economist Carmen Reinhart made the comment at a recent symposium in Wyoming organized by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. An Army veteran who recently returned from Afghanistan was shot dead in Salt Lake City on Friday after he opened fire on a police officer at one of the city's busiest intersections. At the time of his death, 28-year-old Brandon Barrett was in full military fatigues, black combat boots, and a mask, carrying an assault rifle with dozens of rounds of ammunition. Barrett joined the armed forces almost 4 years ago, but went AWOL last month. He returned in June from a year-long deployment to Afghanistan. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamath. This Sunday marked the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Early in the morning of August 29, 2005, the storm slammed into the Gulf Coast, just south of New Orleans. It ravaged the coasts of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, and left over 1,800 people dead. 80% of the city of New Orleans was underwater after the levees failed. President Obama visited New Orleans on Sunday and said that the construction of a fortified levee system to protect the city is underway. He called it a, quote, a natural disaster, but also a man-made catastrophe, a shameful breakdown in government that left countless men and women and children abandoned and alone. Well, we begin today's show with a new documentary that gets the inside story of why the destruction of New Orleans was an unnatural disaster and how it could have been prevented. The Big Uneasy is a feature-length film by actor and satirist Harry Shearer. Here are some excerpts.
We all know what happened in New Orleans on August 29th, 2005. Katrina.
The biggest natural disaster.
Katrina was a natural disaster.
A major American city went through a natural disaster.
Unlike Katrina, where you had a natural disaster.
Katrina, the hurricane, did so much damage in the water.
This natural disaster befell New Orleans.
And yes, it's true, the Mississippi Gulf Coast did suffer devastating damage from a hurricane that day. But as a part-time resident of New Orleans, I became aware over the weeks and months that followed the flood, as did everybody else here, that there was a very different side to that story.
We know that Katrina was about a 1 in 30 to 1 in 40 year storm.
In fact, New Orleans proper likely experienced only Category 1 or Category 2 conditions.
This is contrary to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who are trying to claim that Katrina was a
1 in 496 probability of occurrence.
The Army Corps generals came out in their green suits and immediately said that
that was a big storm.
The reason they're doing that is to cover their behinds.
And you can't out-engineer Mother Nature.
Part of their defense was this was a humongous storm.
Katrina was a storm that was, until then, unimaginable.
There would obviously be no oversight of the Corps of Engineers and their operations. And as we dug deeper, we found clerical errors, we found misinterpretation of data, misscribing data as we look from breach to breach. The kind of mistake at the London Avenue breach is what you learn about in second year engineering.
There was one contractor who, in fact, went to court because he did not believe the flood wall he was building could hold in front of a storm, and he wanted the Corps to do it right.
The contractor, Pittman Construction, told the Corps of Engineers that the soil and the foundation for the walls were not of sufficient strength, rigidity, and stability.
He went to court. The Corps fought him and won, and he was compelled to build as designed, which he did, and it failed.
The design of those walls were based upon a standard hurricane coming through. The Hurricane Katrina was much larger than what the walls were designed for.
In many locations, levees were built at 10 feet when they should have been at 14 feet. They had new model data available to them from 1979 onwards that they ignored.
The intensity of this storm simply exceeded the design capacity of this levee.
This was not a natural disaster. In fact, this was a very unnatural disaster. This was a disaster caused by people. Following the release of our report, we've had three things coming back. Attaboy, go for it, keep it up. The other one, deadly silence. And the third one, please shut up.
Excerpts from The Big Uneasy, a documentary by Harry Shearer that is playing tonight in theaters across the country. Actor, writer, satirist, musician, director, and part-time New Orleans resident Harry Shearer, the voice of many characters in The Simpsons, joins me now from New Orleans. Welcome to Democracy Now! Explain why you decided to make this film.
Very simple proximate cause. I was watching President Obama's town hall meeting here last October, and when he referred to the flooding of New Orleans as a natural disaster, some 3 years after these two independent investigative forensic engineering reports had been issued, which agreed that this was a man-made disaster. In one case, the quote from the UC Berkeley people is the largest, greatest man-made engineering catastrophe since Chernobyl. When the president called it a natural disaster, I realized that what New Orleans knew, the rest of the country didn't, that New Orleans had basically lost control of the narrative of its own near destruction. And I thought one way to try to get it back was to do a factual feature-length documentary.
And what did you think of President Obama's comments yesterday? He called it a natural disaster again, but he also said it's a man-made catastrophe.
A man-made catastrophe related to the leaving people abandoned, referring to the government failure in the response. That's exactly the same language he used last October. He refuses to acknowledge that an agency of the federal government, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, under administrations of both parties over 4.5 decades, is, as the Corps has itself admitted, of course, the head of the Corps who admitted that was no longer head of the Corps within a few months, but that the Corps was culpable for this disaster. Ray Seed of the University of California Berkeley team says clearly, it's the first scene in my film, that had the right kind of hurricane protection been offered to New Orleans, the worst Hurricane Katrina would have done to New Orleans is, quote, wet ankles. If the president doesn't acknowledge that, then we have no hope of getting this thing done right this time.
Well, I want to go to a clip. President Obama and the Army Corps of Engineers promised that a new flood prevention system that will protect against the worst storm in the next 100 years will be ready by next June. This is Colonel Robert Sinkler, the Hurricane Protection Commander for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
The Corps of Engineers did accept responsibility primarily for the four failures that occurred on the outfall canals and in the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal, primarily due to design issues. But since then, we've actually taken those areas out of the system, and what we want to do is really fight the storm surge at the perimeter of the city rather than allowing storm surge to penetrate into the middle of downtown New Orleans.
Harry Shearer, your response.
You have Colonel Sinkler admitting responsibility, which is one step beyond what the president has done. The Corps has adopted a perimeter response. It's a good idea, assuming that all elements of the perimeter system are up to snuff, because once water gets in, they have not fixed the defective flood walls that failed so catastrophically last time. In my film is a whistleblower from the Army Corps of Engineers whose responsibility was to test and install the new pumps on those outfall canals, which are essential to keeping those canals at a safe water level defined by the Corps. She says unequivocally, the pumps never failed, never passed their testing. They failed, they self-destructed, they were installed anyway, and they will not withstand a hurricane event.
Harry Shearer, your film goes into the wetlands around New Orleans. Talk about the role of the Army Corps and engineers around this.
Well, you know, that, now the wetlands is the slow motion disaster that's been going on for the last 30 or 40 years. The Corps levied the Mississippi River in response to the flood, the disastrous flood down here, and they have succeeded in making the river not a threat to New Orleans. But the river, by flooding, would replenish the wetlands with sediment every flood time. And now that sediment gets dumped into a hole at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. The Corps didn't really anticipate that that would start starving the wetlands. Then the second blow to the wetlands was when oil was discovered in the Gulf, and oil companies started making thousands of miles of canals and pipelines to get their equipment out to the Gulf and to bring the oil back. This allowed salt water to intrude into the marsh, killing the vegetation, which then left the soil unanchored. And we've been losing an acre of marsh every hour for the last decade or two. Richard Campanella, geographer at Tulane, who's in my film, says we have a window of about 10 to 20 years to start reversing this before sea level rise makes a futile attempt. That's another thing I looked for in the president's speech yesterday, in vain, a commitment for serious resources to deal with coastal restoration. In this year's budget, the president has asked for the munificent sum of $33 million, one-tenth of the amount of money he's asked for to clean up the water in the Great Lakes.
And how does the oil spill disaster that continues to unfold in the Gulf of Mexico impact the wetlands and the coastal restoration near New Orleans?
Well, you know, the jury, we know that there are some serious issues with regard to the deep water, the plume, and the existence of dispersed oil. The teams that have been out actually scouting the marsh, their initial reports, although they are subject to more rigorous science, are that the wetlands are, you know, have not been as seriously affected by this spill as it was first feared. I think the most important thing about the BP oil spill with regard to the wetlands is it may have put the subject of Louisiana's wetlands on the national agenda for a change, that people are now aware of this fragile but very important resource. The wetlands serve a huge function of what Bob Virchik of Loyola calls natural infrastructure. I don't know the exact ratio, but they serve to buffer and beat down the ferocity of incoming hurricanes, both wind and storm surge. So they are our natural protection system, and we've been losing that, as I say, in a slow-motion disaster over three decades.
Harry Shearer, talk about the distribution of your film. And your recent post on Huffington Post talks about NPR, the initial stand for nothing. Explain what you mean.
Well, NPR announced recently that they're no longer National Public Radio, that the initials stand for NPR. After I found out that they were not going to do a story about this film on either All Things Considered or Morning Edition, I decided to buy some time, you know, those enhanced underwriting announcements at the end of each half hour. And NPR Legal told me this language was unacceptable. Quote, documentary about why New Orleans flooded. The only language that they found acceptable was documentary about New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina. And when I told them it's not about a hurricane, that was the end of this conversation.
And your film is showing across the country tonight?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I knew you could see sort of coming that the mainstream media were going to do basically reruns of the coverage from 5 years ago. Here's me in water, and here's me with a person on a roof, and more footage of suffering people, and some where are they now? You know, where's Ray Nagin now? Where's Mike Brown now? But we're still not going to ask the question, why did it happen? So I thought the night after that whole barrage kind of climaxed, it would be a good opportunity to offer people a chance to spend 90 minutes and find out why this thing happened.
Well, Harry Shearer, thank you so much for joining us. Actor, writer, director, satirist, musician, and radio host. He's the voice of dozens of characters in The Simpsons, and his latest project is a feature-length documentary about the causes of the flooding of New Orleans. It's called The Big Uneasy. We'll end with a clip from the film.
When they couldn't get my own faculty to get rid of me, they made the decision to terminate my position. What was very insulting is they couldn't tell me why. You know, I felt like a good pair of shoes just being cast off.
There have been generally no consequences for this catastrophic failure.
Well, we want to ensure that folks are accountable and responsible for their actions.
I have no doubt that heads should roll. The fact that Ivor's is the head that seems to be rolling is the height of irony.
The Army Corps builds incompetent levees in New Orleans, and Congress says, here's 10 or 20 billion, go fix your mistakes.
It's going to be very difficult to change the culture of that agency.
The Army Corps destroys wetlands, and then Congress says, here's some money to go fix them up.
Whether we like it or not, it was political. Now, I don't say political in a negative sense, just it was political.
Congressmen and women and senators want Army Corps projects in their districts. They want to bring home the bacon.
It's part of how our government works.
The Big Uneasy. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute, and we'll go to New Orleans.
Thank you.
Katrina Blues by Ronnie Earle here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Anjali Kamath. On Sunday, President Obama visited New Orleans and praised the recovery of the city and the resilience of its people. We'll hear more about what this recovery actually looks like in a few minutes. But first, we go back in time 5 years ago to the days right before and soon after Hurricane Katrina made landfall, beginning with then-New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin ordering the evacuation of the city.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish I had better news for you, but we are facing a storm that most of us have feared. Every person is hereby ordered to immediately evacuate the city of New Orleans, or, if no other alternative is available, to immediately move to one of the facilities within the city that will be designated as a refuge of last resort.
And the Gulf Coast region remain in a state of catastrophe following the devastating Hurricane Katrina. At least 80% of New Orleans is underwater. The city has no electricity and little drinkable water. Officials say New Orleans will be uninhabitable for weeks. On Tuesday, two levees broke, flooding areas of the city that appeared to survive the storm.
This is a national disaster. Get every doggone Greyhound bus line in the country and get their asses moving to New Orleans. That's they thinking small, man, and this is a major, major, major deal.
Talking about tens of thousands of people who are left behind, and those are the sickest, the oldest, poorest, the youngest, the people with disabilities and the like, and the plan was that everybody should leave. Well, you can't leave if you're in a hospital. You can't leave if you're a nurse. You can't leave if you're a patient. You can't leave if you're in a nursing home. You can't leave if you don't have a car.
There are throngs of people, easily in the tens of thousands, maybe 40 to 50,000 people, in my estimation, standing on this plaza trying to get to a very narrow area where they're being escorted to the buses. I haven't seen one bus leave yet.
Please, babe. 6 and 8 months. The people just walking past us.
No food, no water, no nothing. Whatever we had, we've been taking it. That's the only way we could survive.
They got the food right here. Let me show you right here. Oh, look, right here. Look. They don't want to give us nothing. Nothing.
Open the gate right there.
Look. They don't want to give us nothing. We ain't drinking no ice water, nothing.
It's not about low income, it's not about rich people, poor people, it's about people. Nobody wants to hurt anybody in this city. Nobody wants to hurt these people who have these businesses.
And they want a little air and a little food and water, for God's sake, that's it.
There's nobody in charge, the National Guard, the police, there is nobody. Somebody needs to come take charge and put organization and get these people to safety, to get them clothes, the basic things that they need to live from day to day.
Well, we've been people being killed down here. People were sending bodies, were just lying out in the street. They were shooting each other. The military was shooting. One of my neighbors said the military guy shot at him. So that's what made me not want to come down here.
Federal relief officials have played almost no role. The head of FEMA, Michael Brown, admitted on CNN last night his agency didn't even know that thousands of hungry refugees were inside the convention center. The White House announced it would have zero tolerance for looters, even for those taking essential items needed to stay alive.
Well, I want zero tolerance for that kind of language being used by leaders of our government to discuss poor people, poor black people who are trying to survive in the, under the most desperate, insane circumstances.
I hate the way they portray us in the media. If you see a black family, it says they're looting. See a white family, it says they're looking for food.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
In Biloxi, Mississippi, the first federal aid arrived only yesterday, 3 full days after the storm wiped out entire sections of the city. In smaller towns in Mississippi, help has still not arrived.
We left for the hurricane and came back Monday night hoping that we could help some people because, I don't know, looking at the response to this storm, particularly initially, there wasn't a lot of outside help, so we decided that really it was up to the people of Jefferson Parish to take the parish back.
What I saw from the federal government was a grand total of 3 boats. Border Patrol agents on 3 boats, 2 airboats and 1 flat-bottom boat. And I saw far more of a response from citizens who had just taken it upon themselves to go and pluck people out of their homes. And they plucked about a dozen out on Saturday.
We don't have any government response here. Everything that's taken place is taken place by volunteers and citizens in the area. Why aren't there 50 inflatable boats in the water working a grid, making sure all these people are out of here? Why is it just volunteers? That's the only people you see around.
FEMA Director Mike Brown is in charge of all federal response and recovery efforts in the field.
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi has called for your resignation, and I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
The president's in charge of that, not me.
Now, his body been here for almost 2 weeks, 2 weeks tomorrow, all right, that this man been body been laying here. And there's no reason for it. Look where we at. I mean, it's not flooded. There's no reason for them to be and left that body right here like this. I mean, that's just totally disrespect.
New Orleans community organizer Malik Rahim. Excerpts of Democracy Now!'s coverage as the catastrophe unfolded in New Orleans 5 years ago. Well, I'm joined now by lifelong New Orleans resident and civil rights attorney Tracy Washington. She's the president of the Louisiana Justice Institute. And we're also joined in New Orleans by writer and community organizer Jordan Flaherty. He's an editor of Left Turn magazine, and his book is just out from Haymarket. It's called Floodlines: Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. Welcome to Democracy Now! Jordan, let's begin with you. Take us back to those days, the chaos, the catastrophe was unfolding. Explain what was happening and how communities were trying to live with as much dignity as they could at that time.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure to be on. And I really appreciate the work you've done to shine the light on these important issues. In that period, right after Katrina, the media portrayal of the disaster shifted very quickly from sympathy for the survivors of the storm to portraying people as looters, as criminals, as gangs that were out of control in the streets. And you had the governor of the state of Louisiana saying, we're sending in troops, they're locked and loaded, they've been trained to shoot to kill, and I expect they will. You had, we recently discovered, the second in charge of the police department telling people it was between them and their conscience if they wanted to shoot looters, if they wanted to shoot to kill. You had this perception among the police that they could shoot whoever they wanted and no one was going to investigate. And that it was so painful to think about these people that were killed, the Madison family who were, and other folks who were crossing over the Danziger Bridge in those days after the storm, trying to get to dry land. Police came on them and fired a hail of bullets at them, shot Ronald Madison, a mentally challenged man, in the back, and then ran up and stomped and kicked him until he was dead. And then even worse than all of that, even worse than the murder, they invented witnesses, they fabricated and planted evidence, they collaborated to invent stories, to have a believable story for what happened. Henry Glover, an African-American man on the West Bank of New Orleans, was shot by one officer, then kidnapped by other officers, put in the back of a car, and that car was later set on fire with his body in it. Danny Brumfield Sr. at the convention center, in front of scores of witnesses, he was seeing car after car drive by with police officers and others, no one stopping with any water or food. He ran up to one car, the car deliberately hit him, the officers then shot him in the back. And these stories were not told. Democracy Now! Told some of them, especially in your conversations with Malik Rahim. But overall, our local media failed us. Every check and balance that we were supposed to have failed us. The district attorney was not interested in looking into it. The U.S. attorney was not interested in looking into it. And for years, what kept the story alive was people at the grassroots, people like Tracy Washington, people like Safe Streets Strong Communities, a grassroots criminal justice organization, the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, who had a People's Tribunal on the first anniversary of Katrina and documented some of these stories. The family members, the Madison family, the Glover family, kept these stories alive against years of silence and against years of the coroner's office classifying Henry Glover not as a homicide, despite the fact there was this burned body in a car. Eventually, Malik Rahim got the story to Rebecca Solnit, who got the story to A.C. Thompson, who started investigating. We had a new Justice Department in 2009 that was finally interested in investigating civil rights cases for the first time in at least 8 years. We had grassroots activists from New Orleans who went to the Justice Department and went to the Congressional Black Caucus and asked for these investigations. And finally now, this story that nobody wanted to hear about is now the story that that everybody knows. And that's because of the efforts of these people right at the center of it, these grassroots activists, these family members that kept the story alive and fought for the truth to come out against this wall of silence.
Well, let's talk about the present moment. President Obama was in New Orleans yesterday. He spoke at Xavier University. Here's a snippet of what he said.
I don't have to tell you that there's still too many vacant and overgrown lots. There's still too many students attending classes in trailers. There's still too many people unable to find work. And there's still too many New Orleans folks who haven't been able to come home. So while an incredible amount of progress has been made, on this fifth anniversary, I wanted to come here and tell the people of this city directly. My administration is going to stand with you and fight alongside you until the job is done, until New Orleans is all the way back, all the way.
Tracy Washington, what's your assessment of how far New Orleans has come in the past 5 years, and how much has the Obama administration done for the recovery of New Orleans?
Well, again, thank you for having me on the show. And that snippet and part of the speech by President Obama, while on the one hand is encouraging, on the other hand is also frustrating to me. We heard a promise from the government 5 years ago that we were supposed to be able to recover. We've continued to hear promises that have been broken. We should have one government in continuity, not having to worry about whether the administration is Republican or Democrat. And what we are seeing is continued blame placed on the victims of the federal government's inaction, such that we can have a president here, a president who I love, who says, we see too many overgrown lots. Well, peel back the onions, peel back the layers of that, Mr. President, and understand why there are still so many overgrown lots. Because you had elderly people waiting on federal assistance after Hurricane Katrina through CDBG funding, who didn't get enough money, who could not possibly recover with $100,000 or $70,000 or whatever it is that you were going to pay them based upon the pre-Katrina value of their homes. You didn't give replacement value for homes for people who owned property, principally people in the Lower Ninth Ward in Gentilly and Pontchartrain Park. And so I give that as an example to say, when you continue to make these promises, federal government, at this time, this fire next time, this 5 years, I want you to put in accountability measures so that we don't have the theft and graft and people rich in Manhattan and Long Beach and us still suffering in New Orleans because of disaster profiteers. That you ensure that our folks here in Louisiana state and locally make sure that the people who were directly victimized by inaction, by the failure of the Army Corps of Engineers to protect us, now get remedy. And finally, that those folks who are still stuck in the diaspora, who are in almost every zip code in the United States of America, are truly guaranteed the right and given free passage back to New Orleans. Because remember, we gave them a one-way ticket out. We need to make sure folks not only are welcome back, but given a plane ride back, given a bus ride back, and ensure that they have housing when they get back here. So that's my impression. That's my frustration 5 years from now. I say this, I will continue to work because this is my home. And I love this city, but let's not put the mission accomplished banner out now, because we got a lot more work to do.
Tracy, give us some of the numbers. How many people still have been unable to return to New Orleans?
Well, look, we have 100,000 people less now than we had prior to Hurricane Katrina. Is that the right number? Probably not, because we've imported so many people, wonderful people here in the city of New Orleans that didn't live here prior to Hurricane Katrina. So, you know, at least 100,000 of our native folk are no longer here. Folks say, well, many of those folks who live now in Houston or Atlanta or elsewhere are having far better lives than they would have here. I give this example, however. I have a cousin, brilliant young man, and his wife who were living here in New Orleans, educators, prior to Hurricane Katrina. And yes, they are doing quite well in Houston. But when they lived in New Orleans as educators and as education administrators, their combined salary was far less than $100,000 a year, both master's degrees. They moved to Houston, they saw their standard of living increase dramatically. But what frustrates them is that they said, look, Tracy, now we see young Caucasian non-educators were able to come into our positions that we should have rightfully had, making far more money than we ever made in New Orleans. Are they happy in Houston? Will they stay in Houston? Absolutely. But there's still that frustration and a bit of anger that they weren't afforded the opportunity to return home and make the standard of living and the kind of living they deserved. So, you know, folks want to play with numbers. I won't play with numbers. I play with lives. I don't play with lives, but we talk about lives, and we say, that's what I want folks to focus in on.
Well, Tracy Washington, civil rights attorney and president of the Louisiana Justice Institute, will be back in a minute. We're joined now by two guests from New Orleans. Jordan Flaherty is a New Orleans-based writer and community organizer. His book is Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. We're also joined by Tracy Washington, civil rights attorney and president of the Louisiana Justice Institute. Jordan, in your book, Floodlines, you tell many, many stories of communities surviving and resisting in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Talk about what happened to the education system in New Orleans.
Well, the education system certainly had problems before Katrina, as Tracy talked about. The teachers were not paid well. The system was tragically underfunded. It was not a working system. But what happened after Katrina is you had a complete shift in the system. So pre-Katrina, you had 128 schools. 124 of them were under the control of the school board. After the storm, the first thing that happened was the entire staff of the school system was fired. All the teachers, janitors, cafeteria workers, 7,000-plus employees were fired. Their union, which was the largest union in the city, was derecognized. It was also probably the largest source of black political power in the city. It ceased to exist. The schools were then taken away from the control of the school board, so that now there's 5 schools under the school board, and the rest are under a combination of either the state or various charters. So we have this, what Superintendent Paul Vallis has called, this 100% choice system, what he proudly calls a free market system. And that, I think, is a microcosm of what we've seen in all these aspects of the post-Katrina New Orleans, where it's this survival of the fittest system. We do have excellent schools in the city now, but you need to have parents that can go out and research and get their applications in and get you into the right schools. We have some great health care available, but there's no one health care system that provides indigent, poor, you know, free health care for indigent folks. That's been taken away. You know, so we have some wonderful housing available, but it costs a lot more now. And if you, you know, live in a home that was damaged, if you lived in a white neighborhood, you got the full amount of money to rebuild. If you lived in an African-American neighborhood, you didn't get the money to rebuild. So it's this survival of fittest. If you lived in the French Quarter or the Central Business District, or you go to the Lower Garden District, those areas were very quickly rebuilt, even though they didn't flood it. They didn't flood. You go to the Lower Ninth Ward, these areas that were hit the most, Gentilly, New Orleans East, they still haven't recovered. So it's like the recovery support went to those that needed the least. And that's, I think, fundamentally what we've seen as a problem with this whole recovery. And that's why I think there's important lessons for people to learn around the country from New Orleans, not just if you're scared of a hurricane, but if you're concerned about any of these issues, housing, healthcare, criminal justice, education, because we saw these issues in New Orleans, but we saw them played out on hyperspeed, on fast speed. Suddenly all the teachers fired. Suddenly all the public housing closed up and shuttered up and the people not allowed back in. Suddenly all the schools taken away from local control and put under state control and transferred over to this charter system. Virtually overnight these changes happened. But I think there's a lot to learn, not just from the problems, but also from the solutions, from this organizing that people did here in New Orleans. And I talked a little bit ago about what happened on criminal justice organizing, but there's incredible organizing that's happened from people working on these issues of housing and education, people that have fought for a just reconstruction of the city, people like Tracy Washington, culture workers that have been organizing on the front lines, like Sunny Patterson, who have been doing amazing cultural work and have also been community organizers, folks like CES45, who have been not just participating in the events, but organizing a lot of this response. And so there's important positive lessons, I think, for people around the country concerned about these issues to learn from.
Jordan, in a recent article you wrote, you cite a statistic from the recent survey of New Orleanians by the Kaiser Family Foundation about the racial disparity in terms of understandings of recovery. 42% of African Americans versus just 16% of whites say they have still not recovered from Hurricane Katrina. Tracy Washington, we've just got a few minutes left with you. You've talked about the right to recovery as opposed to recovery as a privilege. Explain what you mean.
Especially here, and following, I guess, a little bit on what Jordan was saying, this right to recovery really evolves from United Nations principles, but it is embodied in sort of the type of economy and how we lived here in New Orleans and really all along the Gulf Coast. We had a social services infrastructure in place here that supplemented health care and education and transportation because we worked people poor, right? We had so many low-wage workers, and we were an impoverished city. Granted, we had lots of wealthy people here, but those wealthy people really made money off of the labor of poor folk. We took away the entire social services infrastructure, but still expected people to work poor and live really poor, except now it was much more difficult. When we talk, therefore, about a right to recovery, we mean principally that the folks who were here prior to Katrina, those folks who were worked poor, all of us really have a right to be returned, not just to where we were prior to Hurricane Katrina, but we have those same rights principally to education, to housing, to health care, to voting, right? All of these things should be human rights for us, and they've not been restored. And for so many of us who are principled and moral, and so many activists, all of whom I couldn't possibly name here, We sit and we look in these faces every day. We look at these children who are being horribly underserved and undereducated. And we don't say just 365 days from now, but what's going to happen 3 years from now and 36 years from now? What's going to happen with their lives? And if we simply take the time to have a principled recovery based on these rights, basic human rights, we would be so much better off. And in fact, we would be that model city that the president, our governor, our mayor, and our senior senator continue to falsely say we are. We are not there yet, but we can get there.
Well, Tracy Washington, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, president of the Louisiana Justice Institute. We're going to turn now to poet and performer Sunny Patterson. She's from the Lower Ninth Ward, but like thousands of the city's residents, had been forced to live outside and is now based in Houston, Texas. Sunny joined us in Democracy Now! When we were broadcasting from the Lower Ninth Ward on the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina in 2007. She read some of her poetry about the storm.
So we know this place. For we have glanced more times than we'd like to share into eyes that stare with nothing there behind them but an unfulfilled wish and an unconscious yearning for life, though death rests comfortably beside us at night, their moans are louder. They come to visit the guards at the gate and they stay until morning, torturing their guilt-written insides. The silent cries of the keepers are louder than the booms that come from the guns they use to occupy the space. And we know this place, for we have seen more times than we'd like to imagine, bloated cadavers floating through waters of a city gone savage, foraging the land for what can be salvaged, but what can be saved when all is lost. It happened in August, 29 days in. We are now 5 days out of the only place we knew to call house and home. Few things are certain. One, we have no food. Two, there are more bodies lying at the roadside than hot plates being distributed, or first aid being administered, or recognition as a citizen. 14th Amendment, X, refugee. Check.
Sunny Patterson performing in the Lower Ninth Ward and live on Democracy Now! 3 years ago. Sunny Patterson, welcome to Democracy Now! Your thoughts on this fifth anniversary. You no longer live in New Orleans. You're in Houston. Talk about what it feels like to be back in New Orleans.
Well, you know, of course, New Orleans is home. Thank you for allowing me to be on the show this morning. But, you know, we've been talking about this fifth anniversary and the difference that you feel with this this particular anniversary. It's much more of a hoopla, we could say, that comes with it. It's still unbelievable to me at the same time. Yesterday, we had an event. In what's called Hunter's Field. We started over in the Ninth Ward and second line down to this park area called Hunter's Field, but it rained all day yesterday. And to see at the same time, again, the people stand there just to even call the names of people that they know that they have lost in the hurricane. And even as a result, after the hurricane, people that have been lost to post-traumatic stress, heart attacks, cancers that have been festering, and all kinds of other health overdoses that we've been dealing with. So to see these things, and then at the same time to still see a glimmer of hope in the people's eyes, is still an amazing, amazing thing. I know for myself, not being able to be in the city full time is something that still tugs at my heart, of course. But what I do know is that, you know, we have a lot of work to do, and I know that wherever I am, I'm certainly going to be a cultural ambassador, you know, for the city to bring bring a light to every injustice, and even bring a light to, you know, all of the stories of hope and victory and resiliency that go on every day and every moment.
Sunny Patterson, is there a new poem you'd like to share with us? We only have a few minutes left.
We only have a few minutes. Okay, I can. We have not always found comfort in killers. We have not always found solace being rocked in the bosoms of those who silently pray and openly destroy. No, not always have we mistaken mimicry for mastery, or pretending for knowing, or enslavement for freedom. But across my memory marches millions bold, regal, resilient, confident, unshackled feet stumping up spirits to guide us through this fickle material world. We like sun and moon folk, universal souls praying our prayers, singing our songs, Eshu, Ogun, Shango, Yemoja, Oshun, Obatala, Oya, Dambala, Aida, Wedora, Nkango, Olodumare, and Yame. We know all of you by name. We are people of beginnings, of culture, of strength. Not always have we given in to the empty threats and scare tactics of the powerless ones. Not always have we allowed the blood of our sons and daughters to color the streets while we're walking asleep, marching to the beat of death's siren song. They're still wearing their sheets with nooses in reach, showing their teeth and smiling, it seems. But I hear in the breeze, in the rustle of the trees, in the dangling of the feet, they say, please don't let them ever forget. You see, not always have we suffered from amnesia. Not always have we forgotten how to conjure up spirits, ancestor wisdom, fix up a mixture, spiritual elixir, ancient traditions. We like magicians, God like vision. We are people of sight, so no, not always have we fallen for this okie doke or inhaled the hazardous smoke of the manipulators or been satisfied with crumbs from meals our hands have prepared. Hugh said life for us ain't been no crystal stair, but at least the steps are there to push us up higher, teach us how to go beyond the destroyer's disguises, look them in the eyes and be able to see. Cause what's surprising when you know the nature of a beast, and especially when they've shown the same face for centuries. So you tell me, what's the difference between two sisters in New Orleans shot point blank in the back of the head and two women bombed in their car in Baghdad? Or government-sanctioned killings in Kenya and a sister held hostage in a house in Virginia? Or poverty in Haiti, poverty in Jamaica, rape in Rwanda or rape in Somalia, a sweatshop in China or one in Guatemala, or smallpox in blankets, syphilis in Tuskegee, formaldehyde and FEMA, ethnic cleansing and Katrina. I recall within the speech Dr. King made us aware. He said injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere, so they can spare us that drama, huh? We got the heart of them field working mamas. We carry the torch of that ancestor fire. So with every fiber that flutters in our being, with every find that comes from our seeking, with every hearing that comes from our listening, and every sight that comes from our seeing, we must be faithful, strategic, victorious, and free.
Thank you, Sunny Patterson. Jordan Flaherty, I want to end with you. Sunny talked about amnesia. What lessons can people around the world learn from the resilience of the people in New Orleans as Pakistan faces the worst floods in 100 years, Haiti recovering from the earthquake, disasters natural and unnatural? What community-based lessons can people learn?
Wow, it's really hard to speak after Sunny Patterson. My breath is taken away. I think that there's so many important lessons to learn, again, from the grassroots resistance, from the organizing, from the communities coming together. I think we need to learn not to give money to Red Cross and these big charities that are not accountable to the communities that are most in need. We need to find the folks in the grassroots and find ways to support them. We need to understand that this system causes crisis, and so that there will always be more of these crises, and we need to look out for the corporations that will try to profit off these crises, what Naomi Klein has called the shock doctrine, these politicians that try to use this crisis to take away power from the people and control from the people and shift over to more corporate control, more privatization. But there are communities in Haiti, in New Orleans, in Pakistan that are rising up and organizing. And so we need to support these communities. Thank you again for Democracy Now! For all you do to spread the word about
Thanks,
this.
Thanks, Jordan Flaherty, community organizer, writer in New Orleans, the author of Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. Thanks also to Sunny Patterson, poet from the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans. This is Democracy Now! Thanks for watching.